like a company. Ready!
The Chronicles of the American Civil War begins now. And here's your host, Bob O'Connor.
The years creep slowly by, Lorena. The snow is on the grass again.
Welcome to the Chronicles of the American Civil War, the podcast that will attempt to answer most any question you might have about this interesting time in history. This is podcast number 59. We are broadcasting from the podcast studio of Radio Heart Media from room 205 in the Good Building, 113 West Liberty Street in Charlestown, West Virginia. Logistically, this podcast will post each week on Thursday afternoon and is available on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play. I've been asked to speak to my first book, The Perfect Steel Trap, Harper's Ferry, 1859. It is a historical fiction account of the John Brown Raid of Harper's Ferry, with 24 different persons giving eyewitness accounts. A particular interest in the book that was named finalist in National Book Awards by Best Books are descriptions of seven of John Brown's raiders who escaped, something that had not been written about before. By the way, I am presently working on the prequel, which is the book before The Perfect Steel Trap, Harper's Ferry, 1859, a book describing who the raiders were, how they became affiliated with John Brown, and how they got to the Kennedy Farm so that they could participate in the raid. That is scheduled probably in late 2019. I also received the proof of my children's book and am finalizing just a few corrections. For information on my 12 Civil War books, visit my website at www.boboconnorbooks.com. You're listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. Our guest today is Andrew Carroll. Andrew is the founding director of the Center for American War Letters at Chapman University. He is also the editor of several New York Times bestsellers, which we'll be talking about today. Welcome, Andrew.
Good to be with you.
Please give us a little bit of your background.
Sure. I mean, I would say probably the biggest irony of my working on this war letters project is that I don't come from a military family, and I actually hated history growing up. I was not one of those kids who loved going to battlefields, that sort of thing. My eyes just kind of rolled over every time we came to the history part in class and so forth. And really, it wasn't until my sophomore year in college that everything changed. Our house in Washington, D.C., burned to the ground. This is December, again, of my sophomore year, and everything we had was destroyed. And the worst part of it was losing all of our family memorabilia. Now, we didn't have war letters per se, but just, you know, letters and photos and things that were just truly irreplaceable. And by sheer coincidence, a couple of things happened. One is a distant cousin of mine who was a World War II veteran heard through the family grapevine that we'd suffered this, you know, horrible loss, and called to see how we were doing. And I said, well, Jim, nobody was hurt, but everything is gone. And the worst part is all, you know, again, this family memorabilia. And he said, you know, I was just going through my World War II footlocker, and I came across a letter I wrote I completely forgot about, and I'll send it to you. So I get in the mail. It was dated April 1945. He was a 23-year-old P-51 Mustang pilot in Europe. And the first line to his wife, I'll never forget: Dear Betty Ann, I saw something today that makes me realize why we're over here fighting this war. And he goes on for three pages in very vivid detail to describe walking through the Nazi concentration camp at Buchenwald and what he saw with his own eyes. And I'll never forget holding, it was this very sort of fragile onion skin paper, and thinking how delicate it was, like, and just what a stark contrast that was the weight and significance of his words. And I called Jim back and I said, you know, of course I'll return this to you. And he said, you know what, just keep it. I probably would have thrown it out. And that was kind of the spark. And at the same time, the Ken Burns, you know, Extraordinary Civil War documentary came on. And like so many people, I was just mesmerized by the Sullivan Blue letter. And it just kind of got me thinking about the importance of letters. And I started working on a book of just a general collection. It was called Letters of a Nation. And it it was, you know, artists and politicians and you know, various, some famous Americans, some not so famous Americans, but it was the war letters that really captured me the most. And it makes sense because, you know, they're written in these sort of life and death circumstances. And so I, of course, I included the Sullivan Blue letter. I also found an incredible letter by Clara Barton. There's a letter by Sherman to the citizens of Atlanta that, regardless of what one's views are in Sherman, it's just a breathtaking letter of how he, you know, what he says to them when they and beg and plead him not to invade the city because they have old people and people who are sick and so forth. And just the passion of his words, and he, I don't even remember how he ends it, and he's very, you know, extreme, and he says, we're going to come in and we're going to destroy the city. And he ends it, though, on this note, which I thought was kind of interesting. He says, "But my dear sirs, when peace does come, you may call on me for anything. Then will I share with you the last cracker and watch with you to shield your homes and families against danger from every quarter. But now you must go and take with you the old and feeble, feed and nurse them, and build for them in more quiet places, proper habitations to shield them against the weather until the mad passions of men cool down and allow the union and peace once more to settle over your old homes in Atlanta. Yours in haste, W.T. Sherman." And another letter that I came across was by a slave named Spotswood Rice, and he joined the Union Army. He had escaped from slavery, and he realized that his regiment was bearing down on the very plantation where he had been enslaved and where his daughter Mary was still in bondage. And he wrote a letter to his former master that is also just extraordinary. And it made me realize that one of the great things about letters in general is how egalitarian they are, that anybody, whether it's a major general like Sherman or whether it's a slave who was actually, you know, wasn't supposed to learn how to write, could craft these, you know, incredible words that were almost poetic. And I think that's where my love for letters was really nurtured and where the spark began.
Those are pretty amazing stories, particularly the one about Sherman, because I think the people of the South probably have him up there on their hate list, right along with Abraham Lincoln. And he did show the fact that it was a war, but he also showed compassion.
Yeah, and in some of the private letters that I found that I used for other books that his descendants had and had been published, he expressed that view privately as well. It wasn't just a public letter. That he, and he had spent a great deal of his time in the South before the war, and he had great fondness for many of the people there. And he said he knew that he was hated, but he said, I truly want to see this country, you know, come back together to be rebuilt, and that we're brothers once again. But I certainly understand, you know, the destruction he caused. And the hatred that that really left for generations was something that I think is very hard if you're not from that area, haven't lived through it, or have ancestors who talked about it, to really understand just how truly hated he was.
Your book, War Letters and Behind the Lines, two different books, center on war-related correspondence from every conflict. But how are the Civil War letters similar to or different from the letters of the other wars?
I think, you know, in many ways, war letters are universal. Whether it's Minutemen at Lexington and Concord during the Revolution, going up through the Civil War, or Marines going into Fallujah in Iraq in 2003, that intensity of emotion, the fear, the exhilaration, the adrenaline rush, everything that's going through you as a service member, as a combatant, that doesn't really change. The language has certainly changed from the time of the Civil War and the Revolution up to the present day. It's emails and letters today are much more conversational in tone. And it isn't just that troops back during the Civil War and the earlier conflicts are better writers. In fact, most of them were illiterate, so we don't, you know, proportionally we don't have as many letters. But what is, I think, very interesting about the correspondences from that period, the 19th and 18th century, is that the troops who were literate had all read one book, and that was the King James Version of the Bible. And because that's how they were raised, with that book, their letters did tend to be a little bit more lyrical, more poetic. That's not to say that emails today, and I've read many from Afghanistan and Iraq, aren't incredibly profound, philosophical, poetic, just that they tend to be, and this goes starting from really from World War I on, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, etc., the letters are just more conversational in tone. I was struck, though, there's a letter in Behind the Lines, I don't have it handy, but I can quote from it. And it's written by a Confederate officer at the end of the war, and he's just furious that the South is lost. And he writes a letter to his neighbor, and he says, essentially, I'm out of here. I'm going to head west, or I'm going to go down to Central America. I'm done with this country. And by the way, you tell those abolitionist friends of mine, when I die, I want to be buried face down so they can kiss my ass without turning me over.
Oh, geez.
And I never knew that they wrote like that during the Civil War. I thought everything was just very kind of, you know, very poetic and so forth. But that, you know, that language, you know, was very much a part of it. And it's I personally haven't come across the letters that mention vulgarity or lewdness, but we do have a letter by another Confederate officer who captured a satchel of Union mail. They had taken over a Union ship, so they were going through it, and they found this big bundle, this big bag of letters, and so he's describing them to his wife. He says, "I've never seen such obscenity and such lewdness in letters before." So we don't actually have the bag of what was said, but his paraphrasing of it certainly made them seem a lot more contemporary than we would expect.
That is pretty interesting. One of your Civil War era collection letters was of special interest to me. It was a letter of Aaron Stevens from the Charlestown Jail, the town where I lived during the John Brown raid. Can you give us some insight into that letter?
Sure. So Stevens Aaron Stevens was part of Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry, and as you all know, the raid essentially was a disaster. It didn't really incite a riot the way they wanted it to. Most of the men were either shot or captured, including Stevens, and Stevens was hanged in March of 1860, so months after the raid had occurred, and he was sitting in his jail cell, and you know, I'm glad you brought up this letter because it does raise the point of, like, you know, if one were in a similar situation, what do you write when this is the last letter that you're going to convey to, in this case, it was to his brother. And he just ends it by saying, "I hope, dear brother, you will investigate the spiritual theory, for it is such pleasure to know that we shall all meet sooner or later in the spirit land than mere belief. It has been very consoling to me during these trying times. I hope you will be one of those lovers of truth and right, and help redeem the world from sin and oppression of all kinds. And as you love yourself, as you love man, as you love woman, as you love God, work with your head, heart, and hands for the happiness of yourself and all the world. Be careful and not think too much of self. This is one great thing we should all conquer. Give my love to your wife and little one and say farewell. Farewell, my dear brother. We meet again beyond the tomb. God bless you and yours, A.D. Stevens."
That's pretty amazing, too.
Yeah, and that letter, to my knowledge, had never been published before. I mean, all the letters, this first book, War Letters, goes from the Civil War, and the paperback version goes up through 9/11. The other book, Behind the Lines, goes from the Revolution up through Iraq and Afghanistan. But all the letters are previously unpublished, and I really wanted to make a point. So what happened was, when I started the Center for American War Letters, Dear Abby did a column about this project to save America's war letters. I wanted to do this to honor our troops, our veterans, our ancestors. And she put our post office box in this column that ran in millions of papers across America. And it's like the floodgates just opened. And so I was receiving thousands upon thousands of letters from every single war in U.S. history. And there was no intention of doing a book, but the letters were so good. And again, these were all previously unpublished. And I realized that, you know, I could tell the story of America at war, starting with the Civil War. We did not have as many American Revolutionary letters at that point. We have since gotten some. But with the Civil War, like, all the major battles were covered, from Shiloh and Gettysburg and Antietam and so forth, and even incidents at sea or on the rivers and so forth, which doesn't get, you know, the naval aspect of the war isn't covered a lot. I mean, we literally have a letter written by a gentleman who was in Ford's Theater when Lincoln was assassinated and wrote immediately afterwards to his sister about being an eyewitness. I mean, never before published. And we end the chapter with a really beautiful letter by Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, and he goes back to Petersburg where he was shot through the hip, and this was 17 years later, and he goes back to the battlefield, and there's still shot and shell sitting there in the grass, and he's like, and he's writing to his sister, and he's like, think of it, for 17 years, relic and souvenir hunters have been coming here, and still there are all these, you know, the shrapnel and bullets lying around on the ground. And just kind of thinking back on that day and what it meant and being injured and how he, like the nation, was still healing. And it's just an extraordinary letter, kind of looking back on the conflict. And I thought it was the perfect way to end that chapter. And again, that letter, snippets of it had been used before, but not the full letter. And I just wanted to, appeal to people like me who thought they didn't like history, but to show them that it's about great stories. But I also wanted it to appeal to the experts to be like, you know, of course you know these battles, but here's a new letter about it, here's a new take on it from a letter that has not been published before.
Well, and of the John Brown raid itself, the reason that we know John Brown so well is that he wrote hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of letters.
Exactly.
And we have those. In fact, when I wrote my book about John Brown, it had already been published. I was speaking in Hudson, Ohio, and the library there said, have you ever seen our John Brown collection? I said, no. And they said, we have 164 boxes of documents from John Brown. And I said, well, I'm glad that I didn't know that they were there, because I'd still be writing the book.
Exactly.
Right. So, yeah.
No, and then I had the same dilemma with the War Letters books, because there's just so many great letters I wanted to include. And my editor said, just at some point, we just have to, you know, we've just got to cut this back, but save it for other things. And I also ended up doing a book called Grace Under Fire, Letters of Faith in Times of War, and that one from the Revolution through Iraq and Afghanistan. And it was specifically letters on the subject of God and spirituality, and you know, there's this whole thing of there are no atheists in foxholes. Well, there are, and some of them wrote letters about it, and then of course some found grace and God in wartime, and some lost their faith, and some went through, you know, different kind of emotional ups and downs. But it was a really, to me, a fascinating glimpse of these, many of them very young people. I mean, some of, you know, we have, a 15-year-old Civil War drummer boy as one of the letters, and I think he was shot. And, you know, and men and women in their 20s really grappling with these extremely profound topics of faith in times of war. And I was really moved by those letters and felt that it deserved to be its own collection.
I read a lot of Civil War letters for my writing, and I am always interested in the fact that when they wrote these 150 years ago or whenever, they certainly didn't think that you and I were going to be reading their mail, so they weren't holding anything back that they were telling their mother or their wife or whatever, and that's how you get into such emotional charges that you see in the letters in your collection, too.
Well, and also, they weren't censored, so they might self-censor, but, you know, it wasn't really until World War I that the government instituted, you know, really tough censorship rules, which meant that troops really had to hold back. Now, there are ways that they wrote in code. We have World War I letters where they wrote right after battle, held on to it, then sent it when censorship was lifted, so it's still very dramatic and very intense. Probably the greatest period of you know, letter writing was November 12th, 1918, because it was the day after the war, censorship was lifted, and you have a lot of letters going back from Europe to America, like, you know, hey, I couldn't tell you this before, but this is what really happened.
Right.
But during the Civil War, they really didn't have any, you know, there was no one saying you can't write this or you can't write that. So the letters do tend to be, I think, a little bit more graphic. And plus, I think people just talked about death differently then. They were just much more open about it in many ways. And so you have troops writing to the family of a fallen comrade and saying this is how we died. And it would be very explicit in how they describe it. And it just, I don't see that as happening today as much as, say, back 150 years ago.
Right. One of your Civil War letters was really unusual, and it was a letter of Francis Christian's to his wife. Can you tell us about that one?
I call this the Monty Python letter. this is a soldier who reads a newspaper, and he writes the following letter home to his wife. Dear wife, this day I received an issue of the Star and Times containing the following paragraphs, which no doubt overwhelmed me as much as it certainly must have done you. To be shot. Francis Christians, deserter from the ranks of Captain Truax's company, one which we have known for a long time, was sentenced to be shot and perhaps met his fate at noon today. We have not given this fact publicity before. We did not yet despair of a reprieve for the misguided soldier, though the fact that this terrible punishment is meted for a second offense seems to abide it, end quote. And then Francis Christian goes on to say, I simply deny into each and every specification contained in the above. First, I am not shot. Second, I am not sentenced to be shot. Third, there has not been here the slightest supposition among the men or myself that I was to be shot. Fourth, I never deserted from Captain Truax's company, nor have I ever been tried for any charge for desertion. And then he goes on to say, the editor of the Star should bear a great deal of the blame for publishing a rumor, leaving a whole family on the foundation of what must have been a mere rumor. But this is not the first, nor I suppose the last kindness we will receive from those we left behind. Truly your loving and yet living husband, Francis Christian. So it just reminded me of the scene in the Monty Python movie where the guy's like, you know, oh, he's dead. He's like, no, I'm not dead. I'm right. Still here. And, right. And the doctor's like, no, he's dead. So it is one of those letters that surprises people because, again, when we think of the Civil War letters, we do think of Sullivan Blue or, you know, these very heavy and very philosophical love letters and so forth. But there was humor, there was levity, and there's some other ones that I won't repeat that, you know, how the certain soldiers describe their commanding officers and so forth. But it was that was certainly one of the more unusual finds when I came across it.
Are you saying that fake news isn't new?
You know, it's so funny. As I was rereading that, it's certainly, you know, that idea of you know, distrust of the media, I guess, is certainly a timeless one.
Absolutely. What are some of your favorite Civil War letters?
You know, there's so many for different reasons, and I think one of the advantages of not growing up as a Civil War buff, not being one of those kids who's always running off to battlefields and so forth, is just, you know, the surprises. And whether it's Clara Barton writing, and this again was a letter that had not been published before, on the eve of a battle, and just describing it in such haunting terms of what is to come the next day. Again, the Spotswood Rice letter of him writing to his former master saying how he's going to come and get his daughter back. And again, the humorous letters, which is, I just weren't expecting. And even, you know, the ones of battles that we think we know, there's one after the Battle of Antietam by a surgeon, and he's writing to his wife, and he's like, you know, we win a battle, and there's like this cry of enthusiasm that goes through the country, but if people could see the dying and the wounded here, thousands of them just laying out on the fields with no comfort, and he has this one line that always stuck with me of, who permits it? How do we get to this point that this is what men do to other men and that we celebrate it? And I just thought, regardless of one's views on war, it was just such a striking comment by a man who was immersed in death. And I've always felt like whether it's the war nurses or the medics or the doctors, people really don't give them their due. You know, obviously the combat troops experience the terror, and you know, they those who are wounded and so forth make enormous sacrifices. But the people who see them dying day after day after day, the emotional toll that it takes on them. We talk about post-traumatic stress now. Back then, that they didn't really have a word for it. Maybe in World War One, they started calling it shell shock and so forth, or the nerves. But they live with these memories. And one of the most extraordinary things to me about the Civil War in general is that it didn't produce a generation of novelists the way that World War One, World War Two, Vietnam, and even Iraq and Afghanistan have done. We think of the Red Badge of Courage, but that book that was not written by someone who actually lived through combat. And you have so many tens and hundreds of thousands of men influenced by that. And it's just interesting to me that it didn't produce kind of like the great generation of novelists the way we saw, you know, Kurt Vonnegut and Mailer and all these people coming out of World War II, and Tim O'Brien from Vietnam. But in their letters, there is that represents kind of the great undiscovered literature of the war. And with the War Letters Project, we tell people that we're looking for correspondences from every conflict in American history. And literally just days ago, a woman came up to me. I run around the country giving speeches and talks and visiting American Legion halls and VFW posts and so forth. And a woman came up to me and handed me 300 original letters from the Civil War. And just to see that handwriting and to know that these letters were over 150 years old, every time it just takes my breath away. And she said, you know, we were just kind of cleaning the house and didn't even know we had these. And I know that this is probably similar in homes across America, that, you know, buried somewhere. And in some cases, there's no relation to the letter writer. We have lots of people who move into a house, and as they're remodeling the attic, they find in the ceiling letters that have been stuffed there and lost for generations. And so it's amazing what's still out there to be discovered, and that's a big part of this project, is to encourage people to look for the letters. And we know how difficult, again, we don't buy or sell letters under any circumstances. Everything that is given to us is donated freely. And, you know, A, you really can't put a price on certain letters. It's just too difficult. I mean, I know people sell them on eBay, but there's so many considerations involved. And we just said, look, if you'd like to give us the letters, please know they'll be preserved forever for future historians and scholars and students. And it really is incredible what people give to us. And one of the things they say is, like, look, we know these have enormous sentimental value to our family. But what we're worried about is a generation or two down the road, they're going to throw these out. Whereas we know that if we give the originals to you, they'll be saved forever, which is true. And so at the Center for American War Letters at Chapman, we have well over 100,000 letters now. I'm hoping to get us in the 200,000s, you know, by within a year or so, and ultimately up to a million or more. And I know these letters are out there because if you take the World War II alone, 16 million people served in that war, 16 million Americans served in that war. We have cases where one couple wrote to each other every day for 4 years while he was overseas. And so just that one couple has 2,000 letters. And we just know that there are millions and millions of these tucked away in footlockers and closets and attics and basements. And our job, our sense of urgency, is to make sure that these letters are protected so that, as with our family, you know, they weren't war letters, but everything literally went up in smoke. And I was in Houston before the floods last year, and a woman gave me her family letters, and I got back in touch with her a couple weeks after the flooding, and she said if we had kept those letters, they would have been destroyed, and we're so glad that we got them to you when we did. And I hear stories like that every single day. There are people who had just thrown out something because they didn't know about the project or had just heard about us and wanted to get the letters to us where they'll be safeguarded forever.
Wow, that's amazing. Tell us how one letter about an incident that took place at a train station in Jersey City, New Jersey, during the Civil War especially intrigued you.
Oh, that's, yes, one of my favorite stories. And this actually led to a whole other book and project. So my main passion, my main focus is to preserve war letters. That's what I do 7 days a week. So I was just doing some research on the Civil War, came across a story about a young man who was at that Jersey station. It's really just over the river from Manhattan. And he was standing on the train platform, and he fell. And he was caught in between the train, which was still in the station, and the platform. And the conductor didn't see him. So the conductor signaled for the train to go. And he was just about to be crushed under the wheels of the train when another man saw him, grabbed him by the back of the lapels, and pulled him to safety. The man who had fallen was Robert Todd Lincoln, the son of the president. The man who pulled him to safety was Edwin Booth, brother of John Wilkes. This happened a year before the assassination. Now, when I first heard this story, I thought this must be apocryphal. Maybe the two men were at a train station together, and then someone thought, hey, let's, you know, make this story more interesting and say that one saved the life of the other. I eventually found a letter written by Robert Todd Lincoln to the editor of a magazine in which he gave a moment-by-moment account of what happened, and it's exactly as it was stated, that he fell, he was about to be killed, and Edwin Booth saved his life. And he knew who Edwin Booth was because Booth was a famous actor, so he recognized him immediately. And apparently the men had no other communication after that, which is interesting. But it is true that a Booth saved the life of a Lincoln. And, you know, people have talked about, I'm always interested in these what if, or we officially call them counterfactual history, like sort of, you know, what if history had gone in a different direction. Lincoln had already lost two other sons. And if Robert Todd, this is during the war, had been killed, and they very, you know, Robert Todd wanted to serve in combat, Mary Todd said absolutely not, he's going to serve, you know, in an office role, something that Robert Todd was very upset about. But if Robert Todd had been killed, what impact would that have had on the Lincolns, who were already, you know, in great misery over the loss of their other children? And so it's just one of those fascinating little moments of history. And what makes me interested is that I went to the exchange place where it occurred, and the train station has been moved around a little bit, but I see all those commuters, all those tourists, all those people standing there on that platform. And, you know, I bet 99.9% of them never knew that this incredible encounter took place back in 1864 or so, and involved, you know, two very famous individuals.
That is a great story. I, because of my writings about John Brown, John Wilkes Booth was actually at the trial and hanging of John Brown. So I actually had run across that story. That is a fascinating and very ironic story. I know how it intrigued you. It has certainly intrigued me over the years. I'm thinking that this project has certainly expanded since you first got started. Where does the War Letters Project stand now, and how do you see it progressing?
So I feel like we're just getting going. I'd collected about 100,000 war letters before I got involved with Chapman University. I was doing this as a one-man operation. And a professor at Chapman named John Bennett, who was in the theater department, had heard about my travels. I've been to all 50 states. I've also been to 40 countries around the globe, including Iraq and Afghanistan, where I got emails and letters by troops who were serving there. And John said, I think your story, woven in with the best letters you found, could be the basis of a play. And I said, I've been thinking the same thing. I've been sort of working on a script. And we decided to workshop it at Chapman with their theater departments, at one of the best theater departments in the country. I fell in love with the school. The students were so respectful of the material. The administration, the other faculty members could not have been more supportive. And I decided, you know, these letters deserve a good home. And Chapman, I said, I'll give you the entire collection free of charge, no tax write-off, no nothing. But I just want a guarantee that these letters will be preserved here forever. They said, not only that, we want to expand the project. So we will help you travel the country and talk about this and encourage people to look at their basements and their attics. And we do accept photocopies and scans. We prefer originals, but we realize that a lot of people don't want to get rid of the, or don't want to donate originals. We understand that. So we do accept photocopies and scans. And anyone can find out about where to donate letters, what we do. We have a very easy website to remember. It's just warletters.us. So warletters.us, and it's every, you know, our address is there, information about how we use the letters and so forth. And the play is actually still going on around the country. We've had Laura Dern and Annette Bening and Common and all sorts of other A-list and Oscar and Emmy-winning actors involved. So it's the project just keeps building and building, and I will be doing it for as long as I'm alive.
So I had a question. Andrew, I think there's a cultural perception that, you know, in the past we have kind of this romantic idea of human communication, that the people in the past, even though they were so unconnected, right, it took forever for a single letter to reach a person who was at the front in the Civil War, that they were so sparsely connected that they had this depth of communication. We have almost like a romantic idea of that, whereas we in the modern era are infinitely connected all the time, but we have a sense that we are disconnected, that we are alone kind of in spite of that. And I suppose my question is, do you feel like that's true? Or do you feel like that's more of just a perception of where we are?
A few comments on that. I'll never forget giving a speech at an Army base and lamenting how with Skype and FaceTime, we're losing this, you know, treasure trove of communication. And a very sweet woman came up to me and said, you know, I appreciate your efforts to save, you know, these forms of communication. I actually have my husband's emails, which we'll donate to you. But I want you to understand something. When my husband goes away and our little 3-year-old and 4-year-old don't know where their daddy is, when they see him on Skype or FaceTime, they have a connection. And now in the past, you know, even in World War II, a father or a husband could be away for 3 years, maybe even 4 years. And for a small child, that's an eternity. And one of the biggest fears the parents, and now it's the wives who are going off to serve as well in many cases, was that their children just wouldn't remember them. And they'd be, who is this stranger? And so the one advantage of these new types of communication, like Skype and FaceTime, is that they can see one another. And I understand that. I do encourage troops and their families every so often just sit down and handwrite a letter. Whether it's for a birthday, an anniversary, a love letter, you know, whatever kind of special occasion, because just as you treasure the letters that you read from your grandparents who may have been in Vietnam or in World War II, your grandkids are going to have something that they can have that tangible connection to. One of the ironies of today is this is the greatest time in human history to write a letter, because we have so many other forms of communication. So when you write a letter today, you're implicitly sending the message, you are worth the time. And in the past, it's kind of funny actually, letters were seen as when someone couldn't go and visit them in person. So you'd see a lot of letters begin with an apology. It's like, sorry, I couldn't take the time to come and see you. I hope this letter will suffice. So back then, I mean, obviously not in war times, but just regular, you know, correspondences, people sort of were apologizing that, well, you know, I don't have the time to come and visit you, so I'm just, you know, dashing off this letter. Now, of course, we see it very differently. But it is true that, you know, for special occasions, or sadly, I had to write a letter of condolence, and of course, you know, to a loved, we lost an aunt, and this is to my cousin, and it's just like an email didn't feel appropriate. I wanted my cousin to know how much I loved her aunt, how close she was, you know, and why, and how thoughtful she'd been to me throughout my whole life. And so a letter was just a much more appropriate way of conveying that sentiment. But again, with troops and with families, I do understand how these new forms of communication are really advantageous. I just hope that, and even if they come back and, you know, a few months have passed or a year, to leave behind a letter about, you know, this is what I went through, and I just want you to know this is part of your heritage. And I think both the family members and their loved ones will be very glad that they did so, and that they will really value those correspondences as they do from their forefathers.
Wow. I wouldn't have thought that. That's a great question, Mark, by the way. If someone has a letter of interest to your project, where do they send them? I know you gave us a website address, but for those that don't have the internet, how about just a physical address for them to send to you?
Sure. And I mean, I think most people these days, if they don't have the internet, they can, you know, have someone look it up for it. It's just, you know, all the info's there. But
right.
if they send it, we're called the Center for American War Letters. Center for American War Letters. We're at Chapman University in Orange, California, just like the color. And it's 92866. But again, you know, probably the easiest thing is even to go to the library or ask a friend, but warletters.us, because that not only has our address, but it has a lot of, you know, questions people might be asking.
Right.
And anyone who sends in an original, we send them this beautiful certificate that almost looks like a graduation degree. It's we send a letter of thanks for any correspondence we get, even if it's a photocopy or a scan. But we do realize, you know, it's sometimes not easy to give up the originals. And so we truly value those. And again, we preserve everything that's sent to us. We don't throw anything out. And we even include things from basic, you know, or boot camp. It doesn't just have to be combat. Or letters that veterans wrote to each other long after war, recalling a certain moment. So we have a very inclusive view, and definitely letters from the home front. We want to make sure that the sacrifices of the people here back home are also acknowledged. And so those are a big part of our collection.
What is your most recent book?
So I just did a book called My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War, and it's about World War I. But one of the things that really struck me is Pershing had an incident when he was about 5 years old during the Civil War, when some Confederate troops came into his town. There was a standoff with his father. His father was almost killed. And that left an impression on Pershing. But also Woodrow Wilson, who I focused on a great deal in the book. Of course, he was president during the time. He vividly remembered, he was a Southerner, all of these maimed and disfigured Civil War troops coming home. And it's one of the reasons why he was so adamant about not getting America into World War One, because, of course, it was just known as the Great War back then, because he viscerally was so seared by those images of the wounded coming back that he wanted to avoid that at all costs. And, of course, it didn't work out that way. But it is interesting how the Civil War even had its impact on World War One.
And how do my listeners get copies of your fine books?
So all the books are available on Amazon and can be ordered through bookstores. They're all by major presses. My Fellow Soldiers was published by Penguin, and the other two books were done by Scribner, Simon & Schuster, but they're easily available on Amazon.
And how about appearances that are open to the public that you might be doing in the near future anywhere, because my listeners are all over?
Right. We're going to post those on the website, warletters.us, and trying to let people know. Some events are private, or they're just speeches for galas at a military ball. But I also want to encourage people that if you have a place that hosts speakers, I bring the original letters to show people, and there's some really powerful letters. And what I love afterwards is everyone crowds together because they want to get photos of these amazing letters. And I keep them what we call the football. It's this sturdy leather case, and there are all the letters in their protective sleeves and so forth. But they can actually see and hold some of these letters, including from the Civil War. And it's just to show people just the types of incredible correspondences that people have given to us. I have original letters by General Pershing, which is like having letters from Sherman or Grant or Eisenhower or Patton. In fact, technically, Pershing outranks all of them. He's the only general to receive a 6-star in his lifetime. And so it's just, I do kind of a show and tell, but I've done these in places of worship and in VFW halls and schools and major gala events. And so we just try and spread the word. And what I love is how many people come up to me afterwards saying, like, I think you even made this comment earlier, like, I have a letter that you might be interested in. I didn't even think about it until now. I'll try and get it to you. So that's really what the mission is all about.
Thank you very much for being on the podcast today. It was a fascinating program. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for helping us spread the word. I'm really grateful.
You're listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. This weekend's events include Living History, Knocking the Lid Off the Cracker Box, Brown's Ferry, at the Moccasin Bend National Archaeological District, Brown's Ferry Federal Road in Chattanooga, Tennessee. A reenactment, the Battle of Leatherwood in Corinthsville, Kentucky, and a living history program, Under Fire, Hold the High Ground, 1862, at Bolivar Heights, Harpers Ferry National Park in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. Today's little-known American Civil War fact is this. Several regiments suffered amazing amounts of losses in battle. In Gettysburg, the 26th North Carolina Confederate entered the field with 800 and suffered 714 casualties. Also at Gettysburg, the 24th Michigan Union lost 362 of their 496 men. Company A of the 11th Mississippi lost 135 of its 139 men in Pickett's charge, also at Gettysburg. Today's expression that came out of the American Civil War is having the shakes. A soldier who had the shakes was dealing with malaria. Today in American Civil War history, October 25th, 1861, Union Major General Charles Zigoli made his famous charge into Springfield, Missouri. On our next week's program, we will feature Judith Pinkerton Josephson, who will be speaking about her book, Alan Pinkerton, The Original Private Eye. To contact us, please send an email to chronicles@BobOConnorBooks.com. Here's an email message from David Bradley of the UK, a regular listener. Just wanted to say I heard the pod about Ball's Bluff yesterday, and while I have enjoyed all your pods, this one was absolutely tops. Really great. Also, after hearing and learning about Fort Delaware the other week, I have bought the book and intend to visit it. Keep up the great work. Thank you, Dave. We commented at the time that we thought the Ball's Bluff program was excellent. Another email says this: I'm interested in the new Market Heights battle after listening to your episodes on the U.S. colored troops. I'm trying to find information by regiment about the number of men, their equipment, and having a sense of how experienced and trained they were. That note was part of a much longer note from Robert Elmer of Janesville, Wisconsin. Robert, upcoming programs on the schedule further discuss the Shenandoah Valley campaigns and may address those questions. Thanks for listening. Ben Richards, also an international listener who lives in the UK, writes, just wanted to give a shout out from the UK. Love your podcast and all things Civil War. Whilst I still have a few more episodes to play to be up to date. Our last email of the day comes from Bernice Huffman of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Thanks for your continuously fine programs. I enjoy listening each and every week. Thank you, Bernice, for listening. Thanks to Louis Interest of the Sultana Museum for suggesting our guest today, Andrew Carroll. I also want to offer condolences to the family of Bill Beery, friend and Civil War enthusiast who lives here in Charlestown. Bill passed last Saturday. Thanks to my great producer, Mark Guiney, and today's guest, Andrew Carroll. Thanks to you for listening. Please join us next week, same time, same podcast location, for the Chronicles of the American Civil War.
The years creep slowly by, Lorena. The snow is on the grass again. The sun's low down the sky, Lorena. The frost gleams where the flowers have been.